flower friends, my flower friends. This is your host, Sarah Nayani, and on today's episode, we get to speak with Meg from Propagate Positivity, who is the CEO of Cacti and Succulents. Those are two groups of plants that I know almost nothing about, so it was really fun to talk to Meg and learn about some of the varieties that they grow at their house. And then also, Meg works in habitat restoration, and so they go out into the woods and, you know, are encountering all these really cool, funky things like different species of fungi, mold, slime mold is one I remember asking about. So listen in for that conversation. I think you guys are really going to enjoy it. This week was really busy, but it started out with a super fun event. It was a book launch party for my friend Amy Barine from Capital Blooms. I think I mentioned it before, but she wrote a book. It's called Flower Gardening for Beginners. And it's all about growing your own cut flower garden, different like variety recommendations that are good for a cut flower garden and tips on how to grow them. So I really recommend her book, and it was so much fun to celebrate the launch of that. So I drove down to Olympia, which is only about an hour and a half or 2 hours away, I guess 2 hours with traffic. But it was really fun to get to meet all of these growers that I follow along with and, you know, feel like I know, but I don't actually know them. I had never met them yet. And so I got to meet Lorraine, who runs Tibetan Flower Farm, which is where the event was hosted. And then Kelly from Big Bottom Bouquets, finally. I've been messaging with her for so long, and she was so warm and wonderful. I just think that people that grow flowers are the coolest. And the more people that I meet, the more that holds true. So. And then I designed for two different events this week, a community event and a wedding at Hotel Ballard. And normally one event a week is a big deal for me. So having two, it was very busy, but very rewarding because I found that with both events, I had a lot of creative freedom. For the community event, we wanted like celebration of summer, really bright, happy colors. And so we did some pinks, oranges, and yellows, and then balanced out those warmer tones with some cool colors, some blues and purples. So I was just innocently walking along at the flower market, and Ojeda Farms put out a big bucket of Cafe au Lait dahlias, and I just couldn't walk past them. So you know I did it. I put them right in my cart, the whole bucket, and that really, you know, just solidified the design. I find that Cafe au Lait are a little bit hard to work with because they're so big and they can make designs really flat in the front if you just have them completely facing forward. So what I did was try to use other smaller dahlias with them and face them at slightly different angles to create some dimension. And then I used a lot of other flowers and like pops of texture like cress and frosted explosion grass to try to balance out that like sort of flat front. And then I put a lot of like scabiosa and things that sort of are airy up on top to also try to help balance out those big, huge cafe au lait. Then for the wedding, the bride wanted a white color palette with some soft yellows and then some pops of electric blue, which I love. I love when people who are getting married want some color in their palette. And so her favorite flowers were calla lilies and bachelor buttons. And so I was able to include both of those in the design and then some other really beautiful flowers, but it's super hot in Seattle. So I was panicking about whether the flowers were going to droop. And I made sure to put everything for the bouquets right into, you know, vases of water that they could place them in between the photos and the ceremony and then between the ceremony and the reception. And I just made sure to include a little note with that and then just mention it to the bride as well when I was delivering. It's been in the 90s this week in Seattle, which is pretty unusual here. And one day my car even registered at 100 degrees. So it is pretty nerve-wracking with flowers. And for the personal flowers for this wedding, like the corsages and the boutonnieres, I wanted to really make sure that the ingredients I had planned to use that I know can last out of water would be able to in this heat. And so I did another round of testing when I brought home the flowers to process by just cutting some of the ones that I had planned to use and laying them out on a table in my house and just seeing how they did, just observing over a couple days how the quality held up, if, you know, certain petals were shaking off, if the flower shape wasn't the same. And I know a boutonniere or corsage would not need to last for 2 days on the celebrant or the wedding party, but I just wanted to make sure that it would hold up okay before I put them in. I wanted to share a little bit of the results from that. So the first one were bachelor buttons, which actually got their name, I believe, from being stuck through the buttonhole on a groom's coat or vest and being able to hold up out of water. And so on the few that I cut, I did them at different stages. One was sort of like full bloom. One was a little bit like it was fully opened, but you could tell that like it was new pollen and it was newly opened, and then a little bit of an earlier stage. And the ones that I found that did best were the ones that were cut on the earlier side of their bloom but were opened. And then cress was absolutely magical. I got some cress from Margaret at Ballard Urban Flowers. It was so pretty and textural, and it just wants to live out of water. It just kind of goes straight to the dried form, but it looks just like it does when it's fresh. So it was a really great one to use, and I love the specific kind that I had from her. Another one that did pretty well was Nigella, and that's another one where you have to use ones that are on the earlier side of the bloom. And what I found when I really observed Nigella is like there's like a seed pod that forms on Nigella, and it has these weird like tendrils that kind of stick up, and by the time that it's fully blooming, those sort of tendril feet things have spread out into like a circle shape, like an octagon almost. And I found that when those are just opening or kind of straight up, that the bloom is going to last for a couple days, but that when those are fully out, you know, the petals are just about to drop off. And with Nigella, I find that that happens pretty quickly. So the ones that I use for bouquets and boutonnieres were on the early side because I didn't want the petals sort of falling off as the bride is walking down the aisle. I've been really falling in love with smokebush, also called cottonness, I believe is how you pronounce it. And I use some of those little smoky tendrils in the boutonnieres, and I found it added a cool texture to them. So it was almost like feathery, and it held up out of water really well. I still have some on my table that I think I cut on Thursday, and they're just super happy. They just kind of also go into like a natural dried state that looks just like the fresh state. So those worked really well. And then roses. Roses last a surprisingly long time out of water depending on when you cut them. More towards the early side, I found lasted quite a while. So I still have one on my table that hasn't fallen apart yet. I find that processing flowers sometimes takes just as long, if not longer, than actually designing with the flowers, which is pretty wild when you think about it. But especially for weddings and things that are going to get photographed up close, I really want to make sure that I have clean stems so that if I'm holding a bouquet and trying to, you know, weave flowers in very delicately in my hand, that I'm not also one-handed trying to strip a stem or clean a stem. I want it to be kind of right at the perfect stage to just insert so that I don't have to do something one-handed. But I wanted to talk about how long processing takes for a couple of reasons. First of all, if you're a florist and you're listening to this, you already know that. And if you're a customer who's buying something from a florist, I just wanted to put it out there that that is part of what you're paying for, is not just the flowers themselves, but the time and gas to go get those flowers from local growers or the market. And then to bring everything home and process each of those stems and arrange it in a way that's going to work together, to know which flowers are going to work well together and to know which ones are going to last and which ones are not good enough to put into the bouquet or arrangement. So I wanted to use Baptisia as an example of this, which is one of my favorite foliages. I think it's really light and airy, and it makes things more playful. Like it sort of lightens up, loosens up like something that could be pretty dense without it. It sort of reminds me of like a vine, and it just has this really cool like texture and look to it. And I'm growing Baptisia, but it's not big enough to cut off of yet. So I'm leaving that to get bigger. And then I'm buying in Baptisia from Seattle Wholesale from Jell-O-Mold Farms. And they have such wonderful foliage there. I love Jell-O Mold and the foliage that they produce. And I want to do a whole episode about foliage. I'm actually going to reach out to Jell-O Mold and see if they'll do an episode with us. But anyway, foliage I feel like can just add so much to arrangements that's sort of like undervalued or not even seen. Like people will look at flowers and they'll pick out the roses or the peonies, but they won't even notice how just changing out the foliage with those flowers can give a totally different feel to that arrangement. So anyway, back to Baptisia. I buy these big, gorgeous bunches and I'm like, wow, this is such great value for all of this density right here. But then you get it home and you remember like, okay, each branch or each stem has like 10 other stems coming off it. And I want to use all those, but I'm not going to just stick it into a big bouquet like right in the middle, because then it'll just be this huge thing of foliage in the middle of these other flowers, and I want it to be very delicate. So I'll take each stem and I'll cut all the way up into all these different size stems, and then I look at each stem and I say, does this have any like black crud on it? Is it, you know, is it good enough to be really photographed in a bridal bouquet? So because I spend so much time processing flowers, I obviously have a lot of time to think about that. And it just occurred to me as I was doing this wedding, like how that is such a big part of what people are paying for when they're ordering flowers is that, you know, time spent breaking things down into their component parts and then putting them together. Another thing that I've been thinking about a lot lately is just what things in my day-to-day of owning this small business are bringing me joy and things that I'm looking forward to, what am I excited about, and then what things are bringing me dread and anxiety. And some of the things that bring me dread and anxiety are like obviously taxes and accounting. You know, if I could be outside in the garden or designing something, I'd so much rather be spending my time doing that than like filling out forms and doing the paperwork side of the business. Of course, I block off time for that, but it's not something that I ever look forward to or am excited about. And then the other thing is for clients, either for ordering arrangements or for event work that are really extra prescriptive and that don't leave a lot of wiggle room. They want exact flowers, exact color palette. It gives me so much stress because my whole business is based on local flowers. And my favorite thing, the thing that brings me joy, is events or arrangements where I have a lot of freedom and leeway to go to the market and see something super inspiring and then build the design around that. So obviously for events, I have to have a plan going in and I build an ingredients inspiration board for anyone that I'm doing an event for of things that I know will be most likely locally available and looking really good at the time of their event and that I love working with and designing with. But I love to have a little bit of flexibility to add in other things and just sort of go a little bit off script to make that arrangement something that I'm really excited about or inspired by. So I've just been thinking a lot lately about like how to incorporate more of those types of clients that are really into local flowers and excited by using the best of what's in season rather than having to have the exact thing. And I'm just, you know, I'm just thinking about that a lot and trying to find different ways to sort of assess who's going to be aligned with that right when they submit an inquiry and just figure out how to do more of what I love because life is short and I want to work with people who get this and get me and are kind of on the same wavelength. So anyway, just learning as I go and just really excited that I just had two events that really felt like that. This week, the Flower Friends Flower Fact is about orchids. And the question is, how long does it take from the time that an orchid is pollinated to when a plant from that seed will flower? So a little pollinator comes along, goes to one orchid, takes the pollen to another orchid. A seed pod forms, a seed drops, a new plant starts growing, and that new plant flowers. How long from the pollination event to the new orchid flowering? All right, you'll get the answer to that after our conversation with Meg.
Well, today I'm so happy to welcome Meg Meyer from Propagate Positivity to the podcast. Welcome, Meg.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, this is really fun because I followed along with your Instagram account for a while, but I've never gotten to like meet or talk to you. So a lot of these questions are going to be like genuinely like, where do you live? What do you do?
Yeah, I know. I wish like I had a podcast so I could invite you on and ask you questions about what you do. Because yeah, grow girl, it sounds and looks, I love all the flowers and stuff that you post. I guess you have a business. But anyway, yes, thank you for having me.
Yeah, this is really nice. Well, so tell me a little bit about the Instagram account that you started and what kinds of things you post on there.
Sure. I think I started my Instagram account maybe 2020 April, of course, when the lockdown started.
Yes.
COVID, kind of nothing else to do but go in your yard and get in touch with nature, I guess. And I had been gardening for a while before that, and I have a greenhouse, and I had been just growing basically herbs and some hanging baskets and stuff. I wasn't too serious in gardening up until that point. I had cared about it like from childhood, but I don't think I ever like actually propagated or cultivated anything.
So it's like that was the time that you kind of dug in a little bit.
Totally, yeah.
Where do you live?
I am in Tacoma, Washington, zone 8B, just an hour south of Seattle.
And what's your growing space like there for people that might not live in this area?
Well, I mean, I feel like the last couple of years have been wild weather-wise. Nothing has been normal in any sense. Back in my day, you know, growing here, the weather was mild, usually, mostly all the time. You know, we have seasons, but they're not super harsh. I lived in Ohio for a while, so I am definitely a big PNW weather fan.
Yes. No more, or not as much snow, I should say, because once in a while we've been getting it, but
right.
Pretty mild.
Yeah.
You mentioned you have a greenhouse, and then do you have like a yard that you grow in as well, or is it mostly indoor?
Yeah, I do have a yard. I have a front and backyard that I'm like slowly trying to take the lawn out of and add in some garden space for definitely native plants, but some ornamentals too. Slowly but surely doing the cardboard and mulching method. When I first started using it, I was like, is this a thing that you can do? You know, it seems like you're littering almost.
Right.
but it's biodegradable, you know, it composts, it works. Yeah. And I have good results for it.
Well, it seems like you come across a lot of cool plants in your job. Can you tell me about your job and what you do?
Yeah. I do habitat restoration here in the Puget Sound area.
Wow.
It's so much fun. It's so much hard work, but it's definitely rewarding with everything that I get to see and do every day. I feel like habitat restoration is pretty self-explanatory. We go out and restore the habitat. We go to these natural areas that are heavily impacted by invasive species.
Okay.
And our goal is to basically remove them and bring in native plants and help like the existing native plants there kind of flourish. And hopefully eventually the native wildlife will come back to these areas and just see the ecosystem kind of heal itself.
Wow. So how do you guys figure out like what area you're going to go into next and what the priorities are for where you're going to restore?
That is a great question. I feel like, yeah. So I work for a small company outside of Seattle, and we do jobs through the county, and they do surveys to look for areas that are critical for salmon habitat. We work in a lot of wetland areas. So what that would look like is we go hiking in the woods, basically looking for target invasive species to take out, and then eventually get the good guys in.
And getting to do a lot of your job in the field, like how many days are you outside for your job? And is it year round? Are you bundling up in the winter to do this?
We did work this winter. It was very cold. Yeah, honestly, I work outside every day.
Wow, that's incredible.
Every day I'm outside. Yeah, rain, shine, we wear our gear when it's pouring rain and we're out there clipping trees and planting. And yeah, it's a lot, but it is kind of fun. You kind of have to get in the zone and put yourself in your happy place and kind of pretend you're in a movie or something, getting through the wild weather of the Pacific Northwest.
So what are some of the invasives that you look for that are like, crop up a lot in the Pacific Northwest?
Well, first of all, I feel like getting homeowners involved in understanding invasive species is really important because we do work on private properties and we work on like natural areas as well. And lots of homeowners don't even know that they're growing really noxious weeds in their gardens because they have pretty
Yeah.
flowers or really nice leaves. So one of the biggest things we combat is knotweed. I think it's Bohemia japonica, maybe in Latin, the scientific name. And it grows along our stream banks and it is very invasive and it just chokes out all of the natural life. The only thing, nothing can compete with it. And I see it in like people's yards, I see it in businesses, gardens, and stuff like that.
Wow, we're gonna have to get some photos from you so we can post these of like the
Yeah.
different thing, a few things to kind of look out for, because that's really scary that people may be growing it at home and not even realizing that
Yeah.
it's like not good for the natural habitat of the area.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of great resources. Mostly the county's noxious weed board, whatever county you're in, has a lot of information to make sure you're growing good stuff in your garden.
And that way, people can find what's local to them in their area and
Yeah.
see if they have anything in their yard, or maybe if they have more land, there might
Yeah.
be things like that. If they have a stream or a river along where they live, there could be invasive species there as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. Other common things I just see in the Seattle area is the ivy. English ivy is all over, choking out the trees. Blackberry. We have a couple native blackberries, but there's the Himalayan and the evergreen blackberry that are pretty invasive. You see them all along our highways.
And they just like those roots or canes just come up from the ground, and you're like, where did I thought I got rid of you? How do I get rid
Absolutely. Yeah, it's and it's job security for us, honestly. Like, if I do this work, I will never run out of work.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, yeah,
Sounds
it's tough, but
like there's a lot to clear out, yeah, and that everything that you guys are doing is
totally.
going to make a difference for all of the like local ecosystem where you're working.
Right.
And so bringing this back to your home, you said you plant a lot of natives on your property. What are some of the species that you like to plant in your home area?
Well, one of my most excited plantings was this spring. I got a gari oak in my yard, which
Ooh.
also is called an Oregon white oak.
Okay, what does that look like?
So white oaks and red oaks, you can tell the difference between them. White oaks have more of a soft lobe, and red oaks have a pointy lobe.
Okay.
And oaks in particular are they provide really critical habitat for our native species, and their ecosystems are on decline right now because of human behavior, because of logging. So our oak prairie lands are decreasing, and with that, so are the ecosystems that they support. So these beautiful wildflowers that we have, is it camas or camas? I never know how to pronounce, but camas, our wildflower, they grow in oak prairies, so their habitat is being threatened. So my big goal is to have this oak grow up and then take out the grass around it and plant some native wildflowers around it.
That sounds beautiful and just really, like you say, good for because you don't think about when
one tree or one species of tree gets taken out, all the different animals and insects and critters and other plant species that probably rely on that. So
right,
that's really cool that you're gonna, even on your own property, have like a mini, you know, version of that available.
Yeah, absolutely. Native plants support native wildlife species. So if you want to see more wildlife action in your yard, you know, more birds, more songbirds, that is definitely a great way to help support them.
Well, let's move into some of the like really fun and funky plants that you have on both. It seems like that you come across on your job, and then also that it seems like you are really into cacti CEO. Is that what we can call you?
I don't know if I've like earned that title. I guess you guys will have to be.
I think you have.
Thank you.
We're going to crown it today if it wasn't already. It's official.
Thank you. Yeah, I do. I love cactus. I love cacti. Succulents. Yeah, I mean, there's so much to say.
Yeah. Like what got you kind of like hooked on them? What do you find the most interesting about them or exciting about growing them?
I mean, I love the spines. Have you seen the spines?
Yes. They're amazing.
It's just, they're funky. They're different. There's such a variety. I mean, you could say that about any plant, right? But cacti are just built different.
Yes.
They're tough. You know, they survive harsh conditions. They really got what it takes to survive out here.
Well, I always think of cactus as plants that grow in hot climates. And then I learned through your account that there's actually some native ones in the Pacific Northwest. And so are there any that are native to Washington or this area that you could mention?
Yeah, there are. I actually didn't know this either until a few years ago when I started getting hooked on cacti. There are, I think, 3 or 4 species of cactus that thrive out here in Washington and also along the Pacific Northwest, you know, Washington, Oregon, California, and up in British Columbia. We have Opuntia, which is the prickly pear. You ever had a prickly pear flavored something? That's the cactus we're talking about. The prickly pear is the fruit that comes from it.
I had no idea that that would be native around here. I thought that was like a tropical thing. So right. How cool.
Right. You would think it'd be in Mexico or something down on the Gulf. But yeah, actually. So Western Washington, I feel like, is the typical PNW that you would think of, the wet and rainy springs. But if you go east past the Cascade Mountains, it's actually really arid out there. You know, it's a sagebrush, scrub steppe type landscape. Yeah, you'll find rattlesnakes and kind of the Wild West almost picturesque out there. Yeah.
It is so crazy when you go over the mountains, like how much the landscape and the plants change. Mm-hmm. So that makes sense. So is prickly pear live out there more on the dry side of the state? Okay.
Yeah. So there's prickly pear over there, and there's also pediococcus over there. And those are only found over on the east side of the Cascades.
Okay.
But then, so I feel like that makes sense to me. Them growing over there makes sense.
Yes.
But then, then we have Opuntia fragilis, the brittle prickly pear.
Okay.
And that also lives up in the San Juan Islands.
Whoa. So when we're up there, we should check around for some cactus?
Yes. You can find them on Whidbey Island too, which is just like a short ferry ride over from Seattle. And they're able to thrive there because of what's called the Olympic rain shadow. So all the weather that's coming off from the coast gets caught up in the Olympics. So everything just northeast of it gets a lot less rain and precipitation than kind of the surrounding area. So somehow cactus were able to pop up over there.
Wow. I had heard of that rain shadow before, but I had no idea that there was cactus on the island.
So. Yeah.
Wow.
Cool little microclimate.
Yeah. What about like at home? Are you growing mostly native species of cactus, or do you have like a, I'm assuming in your greenhouse, you can grow a lot more varieties.
Yeah. Cactus wise, I just built a big cactus garden last summer. It was kind of my summer project, a little outdoor garden that I elevated with some cinder blocks to get some drainage. And yeah, I have a couple native species in there, the Opuntia, the prickly pear, but I also put an agave in there. And there's a lot of, I feel like Seattle has a lot of different tropical plantings. There's a lot of homeowners that have decided to go the tropical route in their yards. I don't know if you've observed that.
I have. Yep. It's yeah. It's like kind of surprising sometimes. You're like stumbling along and all these different like on a walk or something, and then it's just like a tropical garden.
A palm tree.
Yeah.
Like, where am I right now? Yeah. Yeah, it's that little microclimates specifically, or just really good growing conditions and good garden tending. But yeah, and then I also have some native succulents that I grow and propagate that that I have trailing around the little cactus garden.
And so how do you propagate a cactus, or can you propagate a cactus and succulents, or just succulents? I don't even know. I know nothing about these plants.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure there's the, you've heard of the infamous prop lifting at department stores when you find the little leaf on the ground and you put it in the pot. So, I mean, cactus and succulents are great at growing roots.
Okay.
And they're also, I mean, they're drought tolerant. They don't need water for a really long time. They're able to survive. So if you, it depends on the species, but with most succulents, like sedum, and most cacti, like prickly pear, you can just take off one of the nodes, like just break off one of the paddles and just stick it on top of some dirt and call it a day, and it'll slowly root.
Wow. How long does that usually take for like the average variety?
It depends. You know, it depends on the sunlight that it's getting. And I usually mist it, give it some water every once in a while. It can take a couple weeks. I mean, honestly, it could take about a week or so for it to just to start rooting.
That's really fast. Yeah. And then you can just grow it in that dirt. And what are like some of the general basics for growing cacti? And is it similar or the same for succulents, the growing conditions?
Yeah. So all cacti are succulents, but not all succulents are cacti, right?
Oh, I did not know that.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So cacti are a type of succulent.
Okay. Got it.
Yeah. So succulent, I guess, I think of succulent as like the type of leaf and growth that it is. Like it looks, succulents look succulent to me.
So for growing them, is it just regular soil that you use, or do you use some sort of drier combination?
So you want to make sure that material that you're using, that you have inorganic material as well as the organic.
Okay.
So a lot of just like regular potting soil that you'll buy from the store has mostly like peat moss and compost in it.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have much perlite, pumice, sand, or granite.
Okay.
Which are all things that cactus are going to need in order to not experience like root rot. Yeah. So you want to make sure the soil is more rocky. You want to spice it up a little bit for your cacti.
And then do you want to, like, obviously the native ones can survive outside during the winter.
Yeah.
But for the ones that you have in like your greenhouse, you know, what are like the year-round conditions that you're giving those, like what general temperature range, things like that?
So it depends on the species. You definitely want to make sure that you're cultivating a collection that will survive in your climate. I definitely didn't follow that advice last season. I bought a bunch of cacti that weren't particularly fond of the cold, and I lost them over the winter, unfortunately.
Okay, yeah.
Just because my greenhouse isn't heated.
And it was a cold winter this year.
It was a very cold winter. Yeah. I did take my favorite cacti and put them in my house.
Good.
For safekeeping with a little grow light for the winter.
Nice. Good. So it's still basically like year-round light and warmth, it sounds like, for a lot of cactus.
Right. Okay. Yeah. The native stuff usually will do okay as long as it's in good substrate, as long as it's not too organic. But then if you're moving into things that aren't really accustomed to growing around here, you'll want to move them inside.
Gotcha. Okay. So maybe potting them up, and maybe you could have something like on your patio in the summer and then bring it inside in the winter.
Yeah.
And then is there a certain variety of cactus that you'd recommend for just a total beginner who is really fascinated by the form like you are, but like doesn't know where to start? Like, what would you recommend they get started with?
Sure. I mean, you can start with any sort of succulent. Sedum is a great succulent starter just because it's so hardy and growth. You can't really kill it. There's some invasive sedums that just come and dominate these little landscapes. So maybe stay away from those. Yeah, or like chicks and hens are a great starter succulent, just to kind of see how much water you should be giving these types of plants. And prickly pear. I mean, I'll always suggest that because it's easy to grow and fun.
Okay, I love that. And where do you go to buy cactus?
I mean, there's a big community online that just sells them through like different accounts. And that's a way that I've found a lot of different, like really unique species that I have. And then oftentimes I'll find them at like specialty nurseries around here in the Tacoma area. And actually, I actually found some really cool cacti this last weekend at Trader Joe's.
Whoa.
Randomly. Like very randomly. This isn't sponsored.
Do you ever find that like once you're really into something, you start seeing it everywhere? And so like I would never even guess that Trader Joe's would have cactus, but it's like if you're looking, if your eyes are attuned to it, you might find it.
Right. Yeah. Like that hunter gatherer type eye looking out for this, whatever you're looking for.
What was the kind that you found at Trader Joe's that was rare?
Its common name is the agave cactus.
Okay.
And it's like, I don't think it's like super rare, but it's really cool. It's unique. It's different. And I never see it anywhere, but Trader Joe's has a supplier that loves to grow it, apparently.
That's a great hot tip. I would never expect that. So
yes. Well, okay. Maybe don't air this because now my secret's out and they're going to take all the good ones.
Maybe we'll just like put a protective barrier around your local TJs and then.
Yes. Okay. Go to every TJ except for the Tacoma area ones. Thank you.
So tell me about some of the coolest cacti in your collection. What are some of your favorites or rare ones, things that you just love or excited by?
I like the weird ones, the weird guys.
Yes.
The ones that are monstrose. So there's, I don't really know the science behind it, but when the cactus is growing, it starts to develop irregular growth patterns. So they start getting lumpy and funky and they start cresting and they start looking kind of like a brain almost, instead of just like a straight cylindrical type cactus. So those are always really unique. I like that. And there's many species that'll do that, that just have this gene that'll turn on and they'll start creating irregular growth.
That sounds kind of awesome.
I'm into that. I know. It's so cool. Live your life. Be who you are.
Be you. Exactly.
That's the message.
Yeah. And I saw you posted one type that only bloomed for one night. What kind was that?
That is a serious species of cactus called a night blooming cactus. And yeah, it only blooms for one night. There's a bunch of different species under the Sirius genus. I think the one I have is Sirius Peruvianus, which I think is the common one, the most common one maybe. And yeah, so it blooms at night. It is pollinated by night pollinators. And can you take a guess of what might pollinate it at night?
Maybe bats?
Bats.
Bats. Yep. Wow, that's so cool. So how do they know when it's going to flower?
That is a great question.
I just like animals amaze me and plants amaze me. Like the timing of that.
Yes. And I mean, yeah. And they smell so great. So I don't know if that is kind of a way that the bats hone in on it, but just if you're walking down the street and you have these stands of Sirius cacti, like, I wish I lived down south sometimes just to experience that, walk down the street and just smell all of these beautiful flowers blooming in the middle of the night.
I think this calls for a field trip.
Yes. Who is sponsoring this?
Exactly. We need a field trip to go smell these on the night that they're going to bloom. So the one in your house, like, does it give any indication beforehand that it's about to bloom? Like, how do you know which night to like stay up and watch it?
Well, it starts growing this little flower bud. I'm not sure if you could call it an inflorescent, but it takes weeks for the flower bud to mature.
Okay.
So you definitely have warning. It's not just random, basically.
But you're like, oh, which night is it going to be? And you don't want to miss it.
Yeah, it's bloomed 2 years in a row for me now. So I've noticed it just gets a certain way and you just know.
Tonight's the night.
Yeah, tonight's the night. The petals will start opening up a little bit, and then just slowly as the sun's setting, it just slowly over time expands. And this year I'm really hoping to get a time lapse of it. I think would be really awesome.
Oh, that would be so cool. I can't wait to see if I don't get my own first.
Right, right.
You're making me really excited about these because I do a lot of like just outdoor gardening, Pacific North, like varieties that can handle the temperatures, or I just grow them in the summer. But this seems like a really fun way to get a little bit more year round involvement by like bringing things in and outside.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially, I mean, even with our weather, if it cooperates, I do have a deck, a covered deck in the back. And sometimes even just having cover overhead is really helpful for cacti. Like, it's not so much it being cold, it's that it's the precipitation that gets to them and rots them.
Oh, good to know. So maybe if there's ones that are the most precious, you can bring those inside. But if there's ones that like you think might survive or you've had experience before, you could try leaving them in a covered area.
Yeah.
Okay. Great. Well, you post so many cool plants and facts about plants.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask you about some of the really funky ones that I've seen you post about. So is that okay if I just kind of go through a few and you could just tell me maybe like where you found them, what it was like, that sort of thing?
Yeah, totally.
Okay. What is slime mold?
Yeah. Slime molds. It's hard for me to even talk about them because I don't fully understand them. They're not plants. They're not fungi. There's something else. So I encourage your listeners to do some research into it because it's actually really interesting.
Is it something that you might like come across when you're out walking? Like, what does it look like? I mean, I know because I peeped on your Instagram, but just for listeners.
Sure. I mean, there's a bunch of different types. There's one specifically called dog vomit slime mold, which is disgusting, but that's what it's called.
Love it.
And I mean, yeah, it kind of looks like a dog puked in your garden. I mean, I think it's common in gardens, actually. So I'm sure people have come across a weird, slimy, kind of fungus looking material and just that pops up overnight, basically.
And thought it was dog puke.
Yeah, but nope, that is slime mold.
What about hair ice? I saw that on your Instagram.
That was probably one of the coolest forest finds that I've ever stumbled upon. It really did like stop me in my tracks, mostly because conditions have to be like just right for hair ice to form. So hair ice is a phenomenon when it has to be humid and it has to be cold.
Okay.
So on a piece of wood, you have to have a fungus. So it's the atmosphere, the environment, and a fungus on rotting wood. When it hits a certain temperature and humidity out, this fungus releases, I think it's spores, that forms this type of ice formation on rotting wood. And it's magical looking.
It looks like I'm just looking at the photo on your Instagram. It sort of looks like you're looking down at the top of an old man's head. It really does look like hair. It's almost like an old wig or something. It's just placed on this log, but it's like white hair.
Yeah, it doesn't look natural. It definitely looks like something that like was placed there. It reminds me of something called angel hair. Back in the day, people would use it as like decorations for Christmas. You know what I'm talking about?
Like tinsel kind of.
Yeah, that tinsel-y type stuff.
Back before we were trying to not use so much plastic and
right. Yes. The environmentally friendly tinsel.
Another one I saw on your Instagram was hernia Zebrina.
Yeah.
What was that one?
Hirina's Zebrina. Not sure how to pronounce it, but it's a cool little succulent from South Africa, and it looks like rubber, honestly. It's called this the lifesaver cactus, I think.
And does it have zebra traits to it? Is that why it gets that name?
Yes. So the middle of it looks like a little lifesaver ring that you would throw out to someone in the water. And then it really does look rubbery. Like it looks like you could float down a river on it. And then its petals are yellow and red, and it has zebra-like stripes. So that's how it got its name.
And then another one I saw was Western spotted coral root orchid.
Oh, yeah.
And you said that was a native orchid?
A native orchid.
Wow. I didn't even know we had those.
We do. We have a couple different kinds of native orchid. This, the rattlesnake plantain, it's called Goodyera oblongifolia, I believe. So We have a couple different types of orchids. The specific one, the rattlesnake plantain, doesn't have such an orchid-like bloom. It sends up an inflorescent that kind of looks like an asparagus stalk. So you wouldn't look at it and think that's an orchid. But we have one called lady slipper orchid, and that one looks more orchid-like, in my opinion.
I wonder if it's the same kind that we had growing up in Maine. We'd go over to my uncle's house and he had this path through the woods and there would be lady slippers. And at least in Maine, they were illegal to pick because they're a native species there. But I wasn't sure if that was the same as what might be out here.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure it's the same genus, just a different species.
Cool. Wow.
Yeah.
And then, so while we're on like funky plants, I wanted to ask about carnivorous plants. Or do you grow any of those?
I do. I actually did a backyard bathtub bog project.
That's so cool.
Thank you. I haven't posted too much about it just because it's not done yet and I need to perfect it. But I found this random bathtub on Facebook Marketplace for free and they dropped it off at my house and I filled it up with water and like a little peat. I mean, a peat bog, basically. Put it in the middle of that. And so inside of that, I planted a few different carnivorous plants. And then, I just have water in it all year long. And I'm hoping to get a little pump in there, and I can put some minnows or something swimming around.
Oh, that's so amazing. And so do they, are, have you seen them actually eat bugs? I mean,
yeah, whoa. I have. It's wild. I have the, I have Darlingtonia, I believe it's pronounced. It's a cobra lily. It's a type of carnivorous plant. And I also have, I think it's pronounced Sarensia. It's a genus of carnivorous plants. I have some of those. They're pitcher plants. So you can lift up the top and look in, and you can actually see like a stack of flies in there. And they're often like wiggling around trying to climb back up, but they can't.
Oh my, they're trapped.
It's very like circle of life. It's a little bit sad, but I'm like, they are flies. But yeah, I mean, plants have got to eat, I guess.
Yeah, those ones do for sure.
Yeah, right. So I mean, it is kind of cool to see. It's interesting how they have adapted to feed themselves. So carnivorous plants are smart. They will actually send up their blooms before they send up their pitchers in order to not catch their pollinators.
Whoa.
So they time it out.
So for just like, if you take one, for example, like it's putting up its flower first, getting pollinated,
mm-hmm.
and then it's putting up a pitcher.
Yes.
Wow. So what are some things that you think might pollinate the carnivorous, or the ones that you have at least?
Probably bees and flies.
Okay.
Yeah. So the same thing that they're later eating, but they're just making sure they're getting pollinated first.
What jerks.
I know.
They're like, you rub my back and then I'll eat you.
Right. They're users.
That's smart. So rude, but amazing.
Yes.
Wow. I did not know that. That's pretty wild. I didn't realize it would be like maybe the same things that it was later eating.
Sure. Right. Nope. I mean, I guess the bees get pollen and then honey back to their colony at some point, but just wait a couple weeks.
And then I was wondering if there's any places that you would recommend people local to the Pacific Northwest, or even if you've been to other cool plant collections in the country, like, I don't know, botanical gardens or places that people could visit to see some of the plants that you mentioned today.
There's actually a state natural site down in Oregon that's called the Darlingtonia State Natural Site. And it's along the coast. And it's actually this beautiful state park preserved for these carnivorous plants. It's called the Darlingtonia I can't pronounce this. it's a cobra lily. It's one of the carnivorous plants. I have a few in my bog, and it's this awesome boardwalk that you can just walk down and view them in their natural habitat.
That's amazing. I've been down on the Oregon coast a lot and have never realized that that was there. So I'll have to check it out next time I go.
Yeah, you should. It's a bit of a trek from up here in Tacoma and Seattle, but definitely worth it.
And are there any other places that you like to visit locally or further away?
Well, locally, I do love going to Whidbey Island. I think they have awesome diversity up there. I mean, you can find the cacti, the prickly pear, brittle prickly pear up there. So I think that is really fun to see. And they're actually blooming in June and July. So I'm hoping to get up there to find their they have yellow flowers, so it's a bit easier to spot them in the landscape.
Wow. Okay. Well, I am really excited. I'm going to have my eyes peeled in a different way after this convo.
All right. Book your tickets.
And if people want to follow along and see some of the things that we mentioned today, where can they find you?
My Instagram handle is propagate_positivity.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Meg, for joining today. It was really nice to talk to you and get to learn about all these amazing species and
this
world we live in is wild. So it's cool to hear about these.
It's beautiful. Yes. Thank you so much for having me. It was a lot of fun. I appreciate the invite.
Yeah. All right. Well, hope to talk soon, and I'll be following along.
All right. Yeah. See you on the gram. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
I'm so grateful to Meg for joining on this episode. I feel like I learned so much from them, and I just can't wait to learn more. So if you're not already, follow along with Meg on Instagram and just see some of the really cool things that they encounter in their work and some of the cool things that they're growing at home. Now on to the flower fact question, which I feel like I didn't even need to do today because Meg provided so many flower facts. But on orchids, from the time that an orchid is pollinated to the time that a plant from that new seed flowers is 6 years, if you can believe it. So it takes a full year from that pollination event for the seed pod to ripen, and then 5 years for that new plant to grow to the level that it can start producing flowers. So, wow, that's a really long time. It makes you value orchids quite a bit. And it really makes me think about hybridizing orchids and how long people have to wait to see the results from that. Before we close out today's episode, I wanted to give a little preview of what's coming up for the Flower Friends podcast. So I can't believe that we're more than halfway through the second season of Flower Friends. It's just kind of wild to me because I started this podcast back in April, and I can't believe since then how many amazing people I've gotten to talk to. I'm just so thankful for all the guests who've been on, and then all the people that have listened and then provided feedback. It's just already this amazing community, and it's one of my favorite things that I've ever worked on. So I'm just so thankful. I can't believe this, but I wanted to give a little preview of what's coming up for the rest of this season. So in the first season, I did 10 episodes, and I'm aiming to do that for the second season as well. It might be 9 just because things have been really busy. I have 2 episodes recorded already, some interviews that I'm really excited to share with you, and then I have 1 more person that I'm going to try to get an interview with before the season closes. So the next episode is going to be with Rebecca Noble from LLB Florals in Australia, which is so cool. She does the Dish the Dirt podcast, which I love listening to. And I reached out to her and just said, "Hey, I hear you interviewing all these amazing growers in your area, and I love hearing about them, but I want to know more about you." So I got to hear a little bit about how she got started in floristry and how she fell in love with local flowers and what that means to her business and how it's kind of changed everything. And then I'm hoping to fit an episode in with my flower friend, Michelle Nathan from Little Free Flowery, which is this super cool stand that Michelle has set up in Magnolia in Seattle. And she grows her own flowers and then puts them out on the stand and just shares the joy and beauty for free with her neighborhood. And it's just bringing so much joy and, I don't know, excitement to her neighborhood. So I can't wait to talk to her about that, hoping we can get that recorded in time to slot that episode in. And then the season finale for season 2 of Flower Friends is going to be with Renee from Renee's Garden, the Renee. And she was wonderful to talk to, and I got to ask her about how she started her seed business. I buy a lot of my flower seeds from her, and then also I have saffron crocus and scented geranium plants, so it's not just seeds, but I think that's what she's primarily known for. And so that was a lovely conversation, and at the end, she stopped me and she was like, "Hey, should I send you some stuff that you could give away to your listeners?" And I was like, "Renee, I love you." So I hope you guys will follow along at Flower Friends Podcast Instagram, because when Renee's episode airs, we're going to give away a gift card and a cookbook from her, which is really cool. So hope you'll listen in. I had never thought about doing a giveaway for this podcast. Then a couple other things I wanted to update you guys on are that I'm going to take a break, a long break between season 2 and season 3. And the reason for that is that I've kind of overcommitted between having my own business, working a part-time job, trying to fit everything in, and then doing this podcast on top of it at the height of the flower growing season has just been a lot. It's one of my favorite things to do, but I find myself taking up my whole Sunday editing and recording because I just, you know, I learned this year how to edit in GarageBand. It still takes me a really long time. The other reason is because for growers and florists, it's like the height of the season right now. So it's really hard to get people to, you know, take the time away to schedule time to record an interview. And so I'm going to wait until the fall and the early winter to do the next session of recordings for the podcast. But I'm not going to leave you guys hanging that long. So in between season 2 and season 3, so in kind of like the late summer, early fall, I'm planning to just pop in with a few updates when I can, just like short updates of what's going on in the garden. And I thought I would also share just a few insights I have from starting my own business, because I tend to get a lot of questions from you guys about like, what do you do for this or what do you do for that? And what company do you use for this certain thing? And so I thought it would be fun just for people who are interested in that, which I realize is probably not all of the listeners, to have a couple, either a few short episodes on just what I'm doing in case that provides any like interest for you guys or insight. And then, you know, have these couple short episodes just be really business focused. Then I've been thinking a lot about ways to interact with this community, and I had an idea. So I just wanted to float it out there. But in the winter, one of my favorite things to do is to drink coffee in the morning and watch a little bit of Gardener's World on weekends. And so I thought it would be super fun if we did like a Gardener's World like recap, a couple episodes just on that. Again, it can be like kind of a side series away from the main season 3 that's going to be like interviews. But I thought it would be a fun way to involve listeners. So I thought it could be fun if people wanted to watch an episode and then actually come onto the podcast and recap the episode with me. So I'm not sure exactly how I'm going to structure that or like how to like get in touch with people and figure out if they want to do that. But I wanted to float the idea because I'm just in love with Monty Don. I just adore him and just want to watch him. So I thought it would be super cute because I listened to a couple of recap podcasts about like Real Housewives, or my husband listens to How Did This Get Made, where they like watch these horrible movies and like recap and talk about like, how the heck did this movie get made? And so I was thinking about how would that apply in the gardening world? And I thought it would be fun to recap Gardener's World and or maybe a couple episodes of the like Big Dreams, Small Spaces that Monty did. So anyway, just throwing that out there as an idea and thought that could be a fun way to also get us through the winter. The song of the week this week is Famous Last Words by James Blake, and I just love James Blake. I know nothing about him in real life except that his partner is Jamila Jamil, who I'm not the biggest fan of, but musically, in my eyes, he can do no wrong. And so pretty much every week I've been like, is it time? Can I recommend another James Blake song? So you may have noticed the past few episodes, I haven't been singing out the outro. I just got really embarrassed all of a sudden. I'm not sure why, but I'm feeling fresh and flirty again, guys. So I'm going to sing you out today. And if you feel bad for yourself listening to this, just think about my husband, Vikram, who has to listen to me all day, every day, while I have headphones in and there's no background music that he's hearing except for my very off-key voice. So here we go. Ooh, you're the last. Ooh, you're the last of my old things. Ooh, cut from my broken limbs. Bye. Thank you.